glorious assembled devotees, all glorious assembled devotees, all glorious assembled devotees, all glorious Sri Guru and Sri Gurung, all glorious Prabhupada.
Krishna. So it's our great fortune to have the association of His Holiness Bhanu Swami Maharaj. Hero! Last week Maharaj came and Maharaj gave, we started the Bhagavad Gita third chapter, being the part of Bhakti Shastri program. Maharaj completed the verses 1 to 9 in the last time. He was explaining about that how the, though we are actually following the Vaishnava Dharma, and therefore Bhakti Yoga is the main discussion. So there is actually no meaning to simply go through a discussion on Karma Yoga or Jnana Yoga, etc. Yet at the same time, we can understand how the purpose of all these yogas is finally that it actually culminates into the practice of Bhakti Yoga. So it may be in the beginning stage, it might be there, but actually finally the Bhakti Yoga is the one which even these Karma Yogis and Jnana Yogis, etc. have to practice in order to get success even in their own yogas also. So relatively they have their positions and one should understand that. And in this way, even the glory of Bhakti also can be better understood. So today Maharaj will be discussing on Bhagavad Gita verses, third chapter, 10th verse to 25th verse. Come, let's welcome His Holiness Bhanu Swami Maharaj by loudly chanting three times. Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol!
Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Vasudevaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Nityanamane. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pachadane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschachadesha Tadane Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Siyadvaita Gadadash Vasudhi Gaur Bhaktivinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So in the third chapter, the prominent topic is Karma Yoga, which was also, we could say, part of the second chapter as well, especially Nishkama Karma Yoga. So, here in the third chapter we have Karma Yoga. Of course we have both types of Karma Yoga, Sakama Karma Yoga and Nishkama Karma Yoga. The Bhagavad Gita explains, this Karma Yoga is a step towards higher yogas. It's not complete in itself. And it's often we may confuse the two, because within Karma Yoga we do have worship of the Lord along with worship of the demigods. However, we also have to understand that the goal is quite different. So the goal of Karma Yoga is not liberation in itself. That's the goal of Jnana Yoga. And the goal of Bhakti Yoga is not liberation or the goal of Karma Yoga, which is material life, but prema. So we have three different goals. So we have to see the goal, even though there may be similarities or elements which are similar in all the processes, still the goal is quite different. And because the goal is different, therefore the process also is different. The process is determined by the goal. If you want to get a medical degree, then you have to study medicine courses on, you know, surgery and biology and whatever. If you want to take law, then you take law courses. You don't take medical courses to get a degree in law. So if you want prema, you do one type of activity, which leads you there. If you do want liberation, then you do the process of jnana or yoga, and then you get that. And if you want elevation or comfortable life in the material world, then you do the karma yoga. So the processes are quite different because the goals are different. Nevertheless, we do have elements of bhakti in all these processes to make them work. But then we can't call it bhakti yoga because the goal is quite different. But it has an element of bhakti yoga in it, even karma yoga. So that's mentioned here. So you have to worship Vishnu in all of the actions. But free from desire for material results. So there has to be some element there. But we don't call it the whole process bhakti yoga, but rather karma yoga, because this is not the main process, and it's not the goal is not prema in this process. So for that reason, there must be actions for the Supreme Lord. And of course, these are called, here they're called yajna. Yeah? So yajna we usually associate with homa or fire sacrifices. But it's also a general term to mean worship, because the root of yajna is yaj, and yaj is yajanti, and yajanti simply means to worship, like bhajanti, yajanti. So therefore, yajna can mean worship in general, and therefore we use the term sankirtan yajna. It's not a fire sacrifice, but it is a yajna in the sense of worship, to worship of the Lord through chanting the name of the Lord. So when we say yajna vai Vishnu, that Vishnu is yajna, that's the name of Vishnu, it can mean that he is also sacrifice, but it means that all worship is actually meant for Vishnu as well. So it may be yajna. There's other types of worship. In Satya Yuga, they did meditation. It's also a type of worship. And of course, we have deity worship, which was the type of worship in Dwarpa Yuga. And we have chanting of the name of the Lord in Kali Yuga. So they're all worship in oneself. They're all yajnas. They say dana yajna. And I guess homa yajna, whatever. And then Pancharatrik Yajna, and then Sankirtan Yajna. So they're all worship. So therefore we have to do Yajna, or worship of the Supreme Lord, in all of these different processes to make them work. Because ultimately the maker of Karma Yoga is the Supreme Lord, and he's the maker of Jnana Yoga and Astanga Yoga also. So only by his blessings you can get the results ultimately. So therefore there has to be some worship of the Lord in all these processes, but the goal, as I said, is quite different. So therefore we have different types of yajna, but basically it means worship. Now what does worship mean? Okay, we say worship means we offer things to the Lord, so that's okay, we give things to the Lord. But then some types of worship aren't like that, because we have meditation. How is that yajna? We're not giving anything at all. There's no fruit, leaf, flower at all. How is that yajna? Well, of course, then we can say that in meditation we do manasapuja. We offer things in meditation. But then we can say worship, even if you don't do that, we can still say you're worshiping the Lord. Provided that you have the proper mentality. And that is that we are recognizing the superior position of the Lord. He is supreme. We are his servant. So this is the basic idea behind worship, even in the worship of devatas. Why do they offer different things? Because they're recognizing the superiority of the devata. In the worship of Supreme Lord Vishnu or Krishna, a little different, because it's not just their superior, but they're the highest authority of all. So that puts that worship on a higher level. So therefore, it's not just a worship you have to do in Karma Yoga, but you have to worship Vishnu, Supreme Lord. Recognize that he is in a superior position. Not that Shiva and Durga and Ganesh and Surya and Vishnu are all equal. No. Vishnu is supreme, so therefore he is given a special type of acknowledgement. So that worship must include the idea of the superior nature of the Lord. Of course, in bhakti, not only we say he's superior, but we emphasize the affectionate relationship. Then it becomes bhakti. So, therefore, worship in general is recognition of superior person. And we may express that in various ways, by giving things, by serving in different ways, whatever. You can serve in the mind, as I said, by manasa puja, and offer things to the Lord in the mind. That becomes dhyana. You can offer to the Lord through homa. There, the Lord is represented by fire. So we don't get the graphic representation of Vishnu with four arms and whatever. Rather, we get the fire as the representation of the Lord. So this is a step, let's say, a grosser a step away from meditation, which is in all in the mind. We get a material thing there. But it's a little more abstract because it's not an actual form of Vishnu. It's the fire representing Vishnu. So we see the he's represented by Agni, and then you offer things into fire. So that's the Homa. Along with that, there are very elaborate rules to perform the sacrifice. Karmakanda section of the Vedas, that is the Brahmanas and Aranyakas, they give the rules for Vedic sacrifice, which are quite complex. And all of these rules have to be followed very exactly in order to get results from the worship. A lot of it also is Devata worship in that Karmakanda section. Nevertheless, there's also inclusion of Vishnu there. So it involves lots of mantras. And basically the Brahmanas and Aranyakas are the prayogas, or the how you use the mantras to offer different things, and the rules for using those mantras, Vedic mantras. And of course the Vedic mantras have to be chanted properly with svaras, etc. The ceremonies themselves are very complex. Some are very elaborate ceremonies. So there was one Western scholar, he did a study on one of the fire sacrifices, more elaborate fire sacrifices that are mentioned there. And they were going to perform one of those in Kerala. And then he noted that, well, this is probably the last time ever that this sacrifice will be performed, because it required so many different brahmanas who were differently qualified to carry out different roles, and the whole sacrifice took several months to do. So he said, probably we'll never see another thing like this again in our lifetime or ever in Kali Yuga, because there won't be any brahmanas left, so many brahmanas, and nobody will want to do such an elaborate ceremony that lasts several months, etc. All sorts of rituals that go on, a very, very complex ceremony. That was not even the most complex ceremony of all. It was just some, you know, medium sacrifice. But then he said, this is the last time it'll ever be performed. The sacrifice is quite complex, you know, and requires Brahmins, you know, so many qualified Brahmins to do all those things. So that is a Homa, very, very complex procedure. Unfortunately, then there's another type of Homa we call the Pancharatrik Homa, which is a more simplified Homa, and those four Homas are only for Vishnu and his devotees. So we do have fire sacrifices. Of course, we have other sacrifices, Shakta Homas for Durga Devi, etc. But we have Pancharatrik Homas, which are quite simplified over that, so not so complex. These are the different types of sacrifices. So the intention, of course, is to worship the Lord, but then the desire also is mixed, because the main idea behind karma yoga is to get some material result. So it's not, we can say it's pure bhakti in most cases. this chapter 3, Krishna talks about the remnants of sacrifice, that you eat you do the sacrifice, and therefore you worship the Lord, and then the remnants of sacrifice are consumed by the person, and they become free from sin. So this provides a means by which a human being can live and eat, and at the same time be free from sin. Because basically everybody has to eat, but to eat then we have to take animal life or plant life, and then we have sin. So how do we absolve ourselves of all that sin? So here the procedure is that you eat the offerings that are given to the Lord, and that offering is pure, and no sin attached to it. So this is the prasadam. So technically, of course, it could refer to all the elements of the fire sacrifice, but basically the fire sacrifice elements are not edible by us. They throw the raw grains into the fire and ghee into the fire. So therefore, we can expand that and say that the offerings that you make to the deities, that is the offering, the remnants of sacrifice also. And we take that prashadam. So that's a practical way in which we can sustain ourselves and at the same time not commit sinful activity. The process is one means of purifying things. But then, we can also argue, yes, eating is one thing that we commit sin, but then so many other elements of life, we're breathing, drinking water, so many things, and living and stepping on the ground and doing so many other things as well. So, the eating process, we've purified that, but what about everything else? Our whole life is, surrounded by sin, by merely living and acting in this world. What you have to do is to survive. So, in a larger context, then we can say that a person who has dedicated his life to the Supreme Lord, then obviously all of his activities are also exempted. Because his purpose is not for material results for himself. So therefore he doesn't incur sin by all these different activities. The Vedas have another process, and that is the Panchamahayagya. These are to be performed every day by the householder in Karma Yoga. So it means worship of the Lord and Devatas, offerings meant for the Pitras in the forms of tarpanas, offering water, offerings to all living entities in the form of giving them food, and offerings to human beings by inviting people to the house and feeding them. That's Atithi Seva. And Brahma Yajna, offering of the Vedas. That means we recite the Vedas. So these are five things that one should do every day. And then one is absolved of the daily sins by walking around and breathing and sweeping and lighting fires and whatever we do. That's the Vedic process of getting free of your daily sins. In that we see there's worship or respect given to living entities on all levels. Supreme Lord, Devatas, Pitras, human beings, animals, etc. So at least we're giving respect to all beings. So, here, Krishna is talking about how to become free from sin. And then he talks about the whole chain that we, in order to live, we have to eat. But then the food arises because of water. We get rain. Rain arises from, how do we get the rain? Because of worship, sacrifices. And why? How the sacrifice comes? Because there's injunctions in the Vedas to do this. We do certain activities according to the Vedas. Of course, the Vedas are non-different from the Supreme Lord. So in that sense, by following the Vedas, doing the sacrifice, getting the rain and getting the food, we're following an authorized process mentioned by the Lord. So in this way, this whole cycle where we get we do the yajna, we get the rain, we get the food, and then we offer the food back to the Lord. This cycle is inherent in it is supreme recognition of the Supreme Lord. So if we follow that process in life, not only food but all aspects of life, then we are exempted from sin. So a very interesting way of balancing our life with the rest of the environment. Nowadays people are talking about environment and this and that and whatever like that. So they never mention this part, though. Worship the Lord. But this is the important part here. And of course, it involves all the other aspects that they're talking about, you know, don't contaminate the earth with this and that and whatever, and save this and save that and save the water and all that. Yeah, definitely. And that's also included in this whole process, because there's respect given on all levels here. But there's also respect given to the Supreme Lord, who's the whole, responsible for everything, actually, for the water, for the earth, for the food, for life, for human being, etc. So they're all connected together, and the human being has to introduce the Supreme Lord consciously into his activities of survival. Animals don't have to do that. One reason, of course, is animals are limited. And generally, in their natural environment, they stick within their particular confines of sense gratification. They don't go to extremes. Human beings are different. They don't limit themselves. They can eat too much. They can do anything too much. Everything to excess. This is the problem with the human being. So therefore, we have rules for the human being, and this is the prescribed activities of karma yoga. At least you have to come down to that level. So then once you've done that, then you add in worship of the Supreme Lord. This brings that whole thing to a higher level. And then we get the real function of the human being at this point operating. He not only follows rules, but he also includes the Supreme Lord in that, in his life. Okay, so therefore food is essential to nourish the body. But the food arises from rain. Rain arises from sacrifice. So that part isn't known in the modern world. Where does the rain come from? The clouds. Where does the clouds come from? Maybe the sunlight and whatever. And if we have the proper oxygen content and we don't have the fumes up there, all the bad gases, then we get the proper rain at the proper time, etc., the proper weather. So it's all a mechanical process of getting the rain as far as scientists are concerned. But here, the Lord is involved. Supreme Lord is also involved in the whole process. Rain arises from sacrifice. How does that happen? How does sacrifice produce rain? Well, in one sense, we can say you do the sacrifice and you ask for rain and you get rain because you're worshiping the Supreme Lord for a material result, etc. The Lord is pleased if you recognize Him, so therefore He gives you the proper results, which is, we say, a material result. On the other hand, if you put it on a higher level, if we recognize the Lord and follow His rules, then the rules include not disturbing the natural, we can say, laws of nature. In other words, we don't interfere excessively with the laws of nature in living as a human being. So we can say that's what the prescribed rules of karma yoga do. They limit our activities in such a way that they minimize the impact, the negative impact that human beings have on the environment. And then everything goes on nicely. When we start going beyond that and we start, getting sense gratification, exploitation, etc., then we're going beyond the natural limits, and therefore nature is disturbed, and no rain or no whatever, too hot, too cold, or whatever, we get climate change, etc., and then we get problems for the human being also. So therefore that sacrificing means not just the sacrifice itself, but all the rules and regulations we have for sense control. Because in order to do the sacrifice properly, you have to be pure. In order to be pure, you have to follow rules and regulations. So sense control automatically necessary. And why would you sacrifice in the first place? Why would we do sacrifice? Because we have respect for higher authority. We have respect for the Vedic literatures. We understand there are higher principles in this universe besides the laws of nature themselves. So, in other words, we all, behind the sacrifice is respect. So we respect the Supreme Lord, we respect the Devatas, we respect the laws of nature, etc., introduced by the Supreme Lord. And therefore we try to not interfere with the laws. We follow the laws properly. So therefore sacrifice includes all of this, not just doing a sacrifice, but controlling the senses, following the rules and regulations, respecting the rules, respecting the Supreme Lord, etc., respecting the whole system that the Lord has set up, and not exploiting it or disturbing it unnecessarily. So therefore the rain will come because of that. So therefore the behind the sacrifice is the Vedas, which are the word of the Supreme Lord himself. So the animals don't have to follow this, but the human being has to follow the laws of the Supreme Lord. Why? Because he is uncontrolled. One. Second, there's a higher purpose behind this. Not this issue. Just make him act like an animal, like a deer or a fox or a dog, and then they don't disturb anybody. No. But there's also a higher purpose involved. One, of course, is don't disturb anybody else and keep the system intact. Don't commit unnecessary violence. The other is, of course, to gradually raise the consciousness of the human being to a higher level and get him out of the whole system. So that human being is opportunity for that. But in the meantime, we do have to have this sense control, which is necessary to preserve the earth and also necessary for higher development. So ultimately, behind all this, behind the yajna, we recognize that the Supreme Lord is the necessary factor in living itself and of the whole existence of this whole earth. In our existence island, we have to recognize the Supreme Lord and follow his rules and regulations. We do that, and then the system goes on very nicely. And we can live peacefully on earth. Plus, if we follow the Vedas properly, then we can gradually elevate ourselves and go beyond simply living on earth peacefully. Okay, so we don't follow the rules and regulations. That means that we concoct our own rules, or we don't follow any rules, which means that our senses are uncontrolled and we do any type of activity we want. And this ultimately leads to sinful activity, which means by and large that we unnecessarily interfere with other living entities, unnecessary violence to other living entities. That's what the sin is ultimately. And therefore, what does this do? It leads to bad karma on the personal level, and therefore we have to suffer. On the environmental level, we can say it leads to exploitation of material nature, exploitation of other living entities, including human beings, in which more people suffer, and the earth suffers, and all the life suffers, and the whole balance becomes upset, and then no water, no food, shortages everywhere because of that. So it's interesting that in the cycle, it has this environmental concern aspect to it, but it's got the Supreme Lord in here, which is very unique, because all the talk they have in the material world now about environment, nothing about Supreme Lord at all. So it's an essential element here. So then Krishna talks about performing this Nishkama Karma Yoga, not just regular Karma Yoga, but Nishkama Karma Yoga, without desire for results, as an example for others. So this means that Nishkama Karma Yoga is higher than Sakama Karma Yoga, or no yoga at all. So it's encouraging people to follow rules and regulations, control their senses, and also strive for the higher goal in karma yoga, that is to get up to the level of Atma and Jnana. So it's not just set an example, people live nicely in the material world, but actually it's encouraging them to go further beyond karma yoga into Jnana yoga by doing Nishkama karma yoga. Huh? So that's the example that people should set. Huh? So naturally, the brahmanas will be doing that because they are more generally fixed in sattva anyway. So it's easier for them to practice Nishkama Karma Yoga, and some of them may be practicing Jnana Yoga or Astanga Yoga as well. So naturally, it's, I guess, more natural for them. The Kshatriyas are a mixture of Rajas and Sattva, not just Rajas, but Rajas and Sattva. If they're only Rajas, they're not a real Kshatriya. Huh? So because of the mixture with Sattva, they will appreciate and follow the brahmanas. They will also appreciate knowledge of scripture. And therefore we find Bhishma was very knowledgeable of scripture, and Mahabharata, he gets a whole kanda of instructions there. Similar, Yudhisthira, very intelligent. He knew scriptures very well. So good Kshatriya will respect knowledge, respect the Brahmana, and you also understand scriptures to a certain degree. At the same time, he has the Rajasic element there, which means enjoyment in the material world. But that has to be balanced by sense control to a higher degree than others. So therefore, he can also practice Nishkama Karma Yoga if he's a good Kshatriya with some sattva. And a king is the example for the rest of the people. And the people, at least the rest of the people, are on a lower level. Except for the brahmanas, they're on a higher level, so he's not setting an example for brahmanas. He's setting an example for everybody else in the society. So they should follow karma yoga. If they can't follow anything, at least sakkama karma yoga. Better if they can get to nishkama karma yoga, at least put their goal in that direction. Not simply striving for material enjoyment, but higher goal of getting out of the world is also there in their activities. So technically, a person who's trying to realize Atma, he wants to give up his activities. But here, Krishna encourages Arjuna to keep on doing his activities, even if he is detached from them, to set the example for others who are on a lower level. So that is particularly apt for the king and other Kshatriyas who are higher than the Vaishyas and Sudras, who are the majority of the population. So it sets an example, let them follow. At the same time, he should strive for being detached from the results and ultimately detached from the whole process. So therefore we get what is called the Parinishchita devotee, according to Baladeva Vidyabhusan. He is one who performs karma yoga with absolutely no attachment, just to set an example for others, no other reason. And therefore we find some kings in that position, like Ambarish or Dhruva. No material attachment, but they're doing it to encourage other people on a lower level. Is an encouragement for people on a lower level that they follow this process. Now, if they have no obligation to do that for some reason, they're completely detached, then they may renounce their position as such, and they could even renounce the karma yoga, and they could just do bhakti yoga in that case. And we see examples of that, such as Bharat Maharaj, He became a vanaprastha, went to the forest, he had no more kingly duties, and his occupation was simply meditating on Vishnu. Oh, he's just doing bhakti yoga at that time. He wasn't involved in any affairs. So we see that the ashram system itself encourages the higher castes to get to this level of renunciation of their duties, by and large, not completely, but by and large. We can say that even being a vanaprastha is within the varnashram system, so he's still got rules and regulations of varna ashram to follow, but it's more or less minimized at that stage. So we can say he's getting towards the stage of nirapeksha devotee even at that stage. So, and same with sannyasis. In this way, we find recommendation to do Nishkama Karma Yoga without attachment to the results. One may ask the question, well, why you should do that if he's a devotee? And then the answer would be to set an example for others. Others maybe not be doing bhakti, so therefore they're obliged to follow this process of doing karma yoga and then nishkama karma yoga. If they are on a little higher level, then they can do it with some attachment, do the process of bhakti, and also mix them, and we call that the sannishtha devotees, a little bit less, some attachment to following his rules and regulations. When he's completely detached and he's just doing it to set an example for others, then he's called parinishtha. And when he gives them up, then he's called nirapeksha, completely renounced. Okay, is that as far as we're supposed to go? Oh, we're up to 25 then. Here we have people who are not attached, and they do it for setting an example to others. All right. So this obviously refers to people within the Varnashram system. They don't have attachment to doing these things, but they set an example for others. Higher than that would be a person who has no attachment and doesn't set an example for others. So that's what I say is the nirapeksha devotee. He's not within the system at all. An example would be Jadabharat. He became born as a brahmana, but then he rejected all of his duties as a brahmana. He didn't want to set an example for being a brahmana even. So he rejected all, pretended he couldn't figure out how to do the ceremonies for a brahmana or the rules and regulations, and he just sat there pretending he was completely ignorant. So that's a rather, we can say, a rare position of a person. But then we get a few other examples also, like who was it, the sage that Prahlad met, who was just a python, like a lying down on the ground like a python again. completely beyond the rules and regulations. But then also we see that these persons are very advanced as well, completely detached from the material world, not involved with their material body at all, so therefore they don't even follow the rules of Varnashram for cleanliness or whatever at that point. So it's a very, very exalted level in terms of spiritual advancement. So those on a lesser level have some attachment to the body, and therefore they're more obliged to follow some rules of the Varnashram system and whatever. So, but in the modern context then, since the system is not so much intact, we get remnants of rules and regulations of Varnashram system, but not so much. As far as devotees are concerned, then they can follow those rules which are favorable for their own development. And most devotees aren't living within the society or living with families, so therefore they're obligated to follow those rules for family and society and whatever that are mentioned in the Varnashram system, the interaction with other people, etc., cleanliness rules, etc., rules for the body, etc. We can say it's a mixture there for the devotees also. This is a little bit different, of course, from this idea here, where the main process is karma yoga, and bhakti yoga is a minor element. So in our context, bhakti is the major element, and the other things are secondary elements. We do those things which are favorable for our devotional development, that are helpful, that help us in terms of, you know, as I said, bodily functions and social interactions, etc. A little bit of a modification of this particular system, where everybody was fixed within certain varnas and obligated to do certain things. So if one is on a lesser level, there's less and less bhakti involved, then they have to follow the system of karma yoga. If they're not doing bhakti yoga as a major process, then they have to follow this system. If they don't want to follow this system of karma yoga, then what are they? This material world. That's all. So we have three choices here. You do bhakti, you do karma yoga, or you do nothing as a human being. Therefore, according to one's level of advancement, we could say then we do different things. And if we're qualified for karma yoga, then we can go higher, we can do bhakti with it, or then we can start shifting over into bhakti with a minimization of karma yoga, and then ultimately we can just do bhakti yoga and no karma yoga, if we're more advanced. Therefore, the idea here is that we're speaking from the attitude of karma yoga itself, and also of kings, where they set an example for other people by their activities. This is karma yoga. In terms of devotees then, what should devotees do? So then devotees also set an example for others. One devotee sets an example for another devotee. That is also there. The superior devotee is an example for the lesser devotees, etc. And we find in the ancient society that was also there, the great devotees were the kings also, and they set an example of devotion for the people who were under them, and inspired other devotees as well. The devotee, as I said, generally he's going to mix his activities. He has bhakti, and then he may use the Varnashrama rules themselves to help him in the process. So again, that is another he set an example in doing that also. Rather than ignoring the whole Varnashram system, he incorporates rules and regulations favorable for his devotional development, and this is a good example for other people as well.
Questions? Devotees can ask. I have already said my question.
Maharaj, in Srimad Bhagavatam, Shruta Goswami like very clearly explains how by performing Bhakti Yoga one can rise above the gunas.
Mm-hmm.
Like he says, he starts from the Shraddhadan, Shraddhadana Muniya, that verse where he says Sanmat Seva Vipra Punya Tirtha Nishevanat, and then he says about Nastra Prayesha Badreshu, etc. So basically the service to the great devotees is very much stressed.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you do that, then you will get taste for Vasudev Katha, by which the heart gets cleansed and one rises above the gunas. In Vedic context, Maharaj, that Mahat Seva is like very clear, like the Guru is there like in the vicinity, etc., and one serves, etc. But in the modern context, Maharaj, in ISKCON context, like once Diksha Guru etc. may not be in the vicinity, like he may be traveling to various places etc. We may not have much contact. Mm-hmm. So Maharaj, in this context, how one can on a daily basis perform Mahat Seva? Like, and what exactly that Seva?
Well, of course, what is Seva? That's one thing. Huh? One, of course, you serve him, wash the clothes or cook or whatever, menial service. That's one way. Nothing wrong with that. It's okay. And it's all many examples we see of that. But then we also have the Vani Seva, to follow the instructions of the Guru, which are even more important. So one can serve the physical body of the Guru or a devotee, but better to follow the instructions, which is the main function of the Guru anyway. To give proper instructions. So, and those instructions, of course, are instructions on how to conduct oneself to attain prema. So that's also service. So in other words, Mahat Seva means serving the great devotees, means following their instructions also. So we may not do the direct physical service, but if we sincerely follow their instructions, then we've actually got the essence of the service. So Prabhupada also said, well, I didn't get so much association with Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He saw him maybe 3 or 4 times, I'm not sure exactly how many times. He met him first at Uttadanga, then he a few times saw him, including once at Radhakunda, and you know, maybe not so many times actually he personally spoke to him. But then he said, my success, simply I followed his instructions. So success was not dependent on his physical association, but how sincerely he followed and understood his instructions. So that's the service. Of course, the other thing is, when we serve the devotee or the great devotees or whatever, it's not specific to one person, it could be many persons. So therefore, maybe the Diksha Guru, maybe the Shiksha Guru, maybe other devotees or whatever. Even that is there. The service to any devotee is considered to be wonderful.
We hear that bhakti has to be performed according to the scriptures, Shruta Grahitaya. The question is, sometimes devotees, they want to read books other than Prabhupada's, and they may go overboard and they may read all esoteric leela, and sometimes some devotees go to the other extreme that we will not read anything except Prabhupada's books, thereby losing out valuable instructions. So would you give a recommended list, Maharaj? I mean, what books should be read at what level, so that we don't overdo and we don't underdo also?
Well, it's probably a little difficult to categorize this all up to the devotee also. Depends on the devotee. But of course, according to level, we can say that those who are new to bhakti, then they have to understand very basic things like the principles that are in the Bhagavad Gita. We can say the theological principles of the movement, which involve understanding who is Jiva, what is Prakriti, who is Supreme Lord. Very basic things. And then understanding the process of bhakti. What is bhakti? And then in comparison to that, we have here in Bhagavad Gita, Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, Stanga, etc., and bhakti, and we have to understand the differences between that. So that's the initial information, which we'll get from Bhagavad Gita and from Bhagavatam. Then, beyond that, then we have more details, which you could say as one advances, one understands that. So therefore, we can also get that from Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam, a lot of this. We understand more details about Supreme Lord and the levels of the Supreme Lord, different types, forms of the Supreme Lord, up to Swayam Bhagavan Krishna. And why Krishna's in the topmost position over others. And also difference between pure bhakti and impure bhakti. and how it is completely different from Karma Gyan Yogi. So this we will also get from Bhagavatam, as well as the commentaries of the Acharyas, who make it very, they make it very clear the distinctions, and also the supremacy of Krishna, etc. So that a lot of it would depend on the details on the commentaries of the Acharyas. So if we go to the commentaries of the Acharyas and the Bhagavatam, then we can get a lot of this type of information. So that we can say is the second level. Then the third level would be to understand more about Krishna, because Krishna and prema is the object. Ultimate object. So the first one was more basically sambandha, the second the sambandha and abhideya, the process of bhakti, and the third is prayojana, understanding more about the goal. So that's also important, because unless we understand the goal, how we can do the process properly? If we get the wrong goal, then the process will lead us to the wrong goal. We don't get the right goal, we get a wrong goal if we don't understand who Krishna is properly. So that again, we go to the Bhagavatam, we have all the pastimes of Krishna there, and then we also have the works of the more poetic works of the Goswamis, the different works of Rupa Goswami or Vishwa Chakravarti, describing pastimes of Krishna and others in Vrindavan. That also, as I said, is we can't ignore it. But it also requires a certain higher level of maturity to get into that as well. So those three, basic three levels. Interestingly enough, we'll find all three are there within Chaitanya Charitamrita. We get the basics, we also get the types of bhakti, including Raghunuga bhakti and Vaidya bhakti and Bhava bhakti and Prem bhakti, and then we get all the details of Krishna as well. So we get all three there in Chaitanya Charitamrita.
Also, within this context of levels of scriptures and what we should read and how much we should read, Srila Prabhupada also expected all his members to be very much carefully studying his books in this Iskcon society. So even though a person might actually, one has to read all the books of Prabhupada carefully, which means Gita, Bhagavatam, Chaitan Charitamrit, and then even then afterwards when he's reading maybe other Acharya's commentary and other the Goswami's works, even at that time what I understand is that Prabhupada would expect us to discuss from his books. So his books become, as Prabhupada said, my books will remain the law books for the next 10,000 years. So is it not that as members of ISKCON, then we will have to emphasize Srila Prabhupada books, his teachings, and emphasis on a personal reading also from Prabhupada books itself? Though we might also read other.
This involves some interesting questions, we can say, because we read the books of Prabhupada, and then there may be questions, because there may be internal contradictions sometimes. Sometimes they're simply, we can say mistake, editorial mistakes or whatever like that, grammatical mistakes or whatever, contextual mistakes or whatever like that. One place in Bhagavatam it says this, another place it says something else. So then we say, well, what is it actually? So then based on that, then we may have to go outside to understand what is the conclusion, because we can't conclude from that the context sometimes. Of course, grammatical and other things are no problem, but then we get contextual mistakes. He says one thing in one place and a completely opposite thing in another place. How do we solve the problem? And these, again, we discuss, say, contextual things, like the name of a person may be wrong in one place or different in one place from another person, like Mandavya Muni and Madhukya Muni, as the sage who cursed Vidura, or Yamaraj, and then became Vidura. So who is it? Is it one or the other? So then, just from Prabhupada's works, maybe you couldn't say. But of course, you could say that actually, in the text itself, it says Mandavya Muni. And it's only in his commentary he says Mandukya. So based on that, in the third canto, it says Mandavya. Therefore, you say the other one's wrong. But then if you look in Mahabharata, you can confirm that, okay, it must be Mandavya Muni, because everybody else says that. And that's, you know, seems so. We have to, for some cases, we're going to have to go outside. This for those mistakes. Other than others, more complicated statements also that may be confusing, or even like Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga. Prabhupada calls Karma Yoga Bhakti Yoga, so then everyone gets confused by that, you know. So why is it like this, you know? So then, if we go to the Acharyas, then we can get some clarification on that, and that makes complete sense out why what's what. So sometimes we need clarification on these issues. Otherwise, if we simply stick to the books, we may come to another wrong conclusion if we're not careful, you know, about speculating or whatever. So if we have the previous Acharyas and the scriptures to go by, then we can help us come to a better conclusion. And then, of course, obviously, Prabhupada, then he, and like in Chaitanya Charitamrita, he says, then you should consult this work and that work and this work, which he didn't translate anyway. Within his lifetime, he didn't even get to the full of the Bhagavatam, so that means we can't read beyond the 14th chapter of the 10th canto then? Sounds a little weird. So, there's certain limitations on his life were there, so he only completed a certain amount, so it doesn't mean we can't access other scriptures because of that as well.
And in his books itself, he has written, my disciples shall continue with
you.
The question was, knowing all this also, the ongoing emphasis on Prabhupada books reading, should it not be also there? Knowing definitely that there are other commentaries and Acharya's works which are very important, yet should we also, because ultimately what happens is that even among the Acharyas also, there are apparent contradictions. One Acharya may say something and another Acharya may say something slightly different, and also contextual messages based on what time period was going on. Like Kali Yuga, there is so much of sense gratification, so Prabhupada condemns it very heavily, whereas Vishnu Chakra Thakur might not even mention it so much. So such contextual messages also become important based on time, place, circumstances. So should it not be that we do make an ongoing emphasis on the Prabhupada's books itself?
That's why we in these courses like Bhakti Shastri, where it's basically there to read Prabhupada's books like the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam and Nectar Devotion, the basic books, and get thorough knowledge in that before anything else.
Questions from within the class? Any other devotee? Yes.
Maharaj, you said that there are two ways of doing this. One, we follow the rules and we get the rain, and another type of other people who don't interfere with the laws of nature. So, and their actions are also same, that not disturbing the laws of nature, and ultimately they are also type of doing sacrifice and getting the rain. So my question is it like this, is it this kind of second kind of people, they are called as following Sankhya Yoga, means finding the root of the world, which is Vishnu, and then worshipping Lord. And the first, this kind of devotees are directly following devotional service. Is it correct understanding or not correct?
You understood the question? Which Sankhya you're talking about, by the way? No. Kapila and the Bhagavatam, which is basically Bhakti with...
Bhagavad Gita I had read, Sankhya Yoga means people who go to the root of the material world, which is Vishnu, and then by understanding the root is Vishnu, then worships Vishnu.
Okay, so then?
So,
analytical study.
Yeah, but the devotees also. They're not the atheistic Sankhyas. Okay. So what about them?
And so is this correct that those who do not try to interfere with the laws of nature they are followers of Sankhya Yogi, Sankhya Yoga?
Well, they could be. They could be various persons. We'll find that all these people involved in Jnana also, basically, they're minimizing their activities, they're very sattvic, etc. We can say sattvic people in general would be, you know, minimizing their interference with the material world. They have sense control, etc. However, we find that within the system of karma yoga, this is all more like regulated into rules and regulations, so it's a little more specific, not just a person is sattva gun and he's basically peaceful, but he's actually following certain rules to very more systematically to inculcate this level of non-interference. So the non-interference that happens on different levels, tamogun, rajagun, and sattvagun, in terms of the Vedic system and karma yoga. In the material world, there is no regulation at all, so it's just basically, if you end up as sattvic, you would interfere less, but the other ones, there's no regulation at all, hardly. You know, it's very, very minimal, whatever like that. So the karma yoga, it regulates all that into very specifically, into you can follow, you can do this, but you can't do this, and it allows more leeway for sense gratification for the sudras and vaishyas, less for the kshatriyas and least for the brahmanas. So we could say less interference on the top level, more leeway on the bottom level, etc. So as you go upward, then and you get to jnana and sankhya and whatever on top, then there's less interference.
As Krishna says that rain gives food, but Jains, they refute this, saying that it rains even in seas, and there's no one doing worship in the oceans and seas, so therefore the Vedas are wrong.
Okay.
So how do we refute this?
Well, I think this is a very general proposition made. It's not that, obviously we know that the rain falls on the sea also, and there's no worship there, but they get it. And even if in America they don't do yogas, but the rain is falling there also. Well, I say a general principle that, for the human being at least, our existence should involve the Supreme Lord so that the system is balanced. That's all. I don't think it means that, you know, if we don't do yogi, there's no rain, or if there's no human beings, there's obviously going to be rain in any case. But it's simply a means of indicating that the human being has to be careful and observe rules and regulations, otherwise he disturbs the system.
Maharaj ki. Let's thank Maharaj for such a wonderful description of the Bhagavad Gita. So many complex subjects, actually Maharaj made it very simple and explained us. Let's thank Maharaj by loudly chanting three times. Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Hari Bol! Vishal Prabhu.